This morning, I'm reading to you two scriptures. The first is from the book of Genesis. Now, Joseph was handsome and good-looking. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, with me here, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my hand. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Our second reading is from Titus. "Show yourself in all respects a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity." The word of God for the people of God.
They call it the greatest game. There's no referee. You call penalties on yourself. The scoreboard is kept in your back pocket. There are rules, but there's also etiquette. It's a game where you lose yourself and find yourself at the same time. You could say there are parallels between the game of golf and the spiritual life, where we appreciate things like the need for mulligans, playing with integrity, and realizing that no matter what, we have to play it where it lies. These are the lessons we call theology.
Well, let me just say before I begin the message, how excited I am to have new members. You guys realize you're the inaugural group for the 9:30 contemporary service, so thank you for blazing the trail, and we're so glad that you guys are joining the service. And I want to encourage everyone to continue to invite people to this service. I mean, where else do you start off with Kenny Loggins and "I'm All Right" and Caddyshack at church, you know? I mean, where else does that happen? So I hope you'll continue to invite friends, neighbors to come be with you at church, and we'll keep bringing the best we can, and thank you. So thank you, guys. Did any of you watch U.S. Open this weekend? Anyone watch a little bit of it? Oh, just a handful. We're doing a series on golf. I thought you'd be a little more interested. I don't watch tournaments from like Thursday to Sunday. I'm not that much of a fan, but I like to tune in at the end of the day when they're on like the 16, 17, 18, like when every shot really counts. And so I turned it on yesterday to watch like the last few golfers, the guys at the top of the leaderboard. And there's this guy, I don't even remember what his name was, because a lot of the guys at the leaderboard for this U.S. Open are not big household names. Anyways, this guy was, he's in the lead at number 12, 12 under, he's on the last hole, number 18. And on his second shot, it's a par 5, 670 yards. That's so long. And he hits it within a few feet of the green on his second shot, right? Like, just beautiful. But then I watched. And in his chip, he flubs the chip, and it ends up not going onto the green, but onto the rough of the green at the bottom of this big hill. And I'm like, yeah, I know that shot. And then he does the move that I think, you know, I love to do when I'm just off the green. You just throw the chip, the pitching wedge aside, and you just pull out the putter at that point. So he putted off the green, went up this big hill, except he hit it too hard, and it went past the hole and down the other side, and it rolled further away than he was after shot number 2. And I'm watching all this. I'm like, you know, I hate to say it, I was actually kind of like rooting for him to fail in a way. It was like, because I know what that feels like. And then, of course, his next two shots were just perfection. So he saved his hole with a bogey. But it was kind of like vindication for all of us amateur golfers to see a guy at the top of his game, top of the leaderboard, not play so well. Well, I want to talk about the U.S. Open, though, but not this year's U.S. Open. The U.S. Open almost a whole century ago in 1925. In 1925, the best golfer of the day was a guy named Bobby Jones. And this U.S. Open in 1925 is remembered not for who won the U.S. Open, but for the guy who came in second, Bobby Jones. And the reason it's remembered so well is because in the first round, you know, right when the tournament was getting started, maybe I think 8 or 9 holes in, he pulled his tee shot over into the rough. And then when he set up for his second shot, which is a tough shot, he saw his iron graze the ball a little bit and the ball moved. He instantly called over the official and said, I think I just moved the ball. The official who'd been watching him the whole time said, I didn't see the ball move. The spectators who were around said the same thing. They didn't see it move. No one saw the ball move except Bobby Jones. And they told him, we don't think you need to call a penalty on yourself. And he said, no, I know I saw it move. I'm going to call a penalty on myself. Now, what makes that significant is you fast forward 54 holes later. You fast forward, and he ends up tied to win the U.S. Open with one other guy. And because they're tied, then they go on to play 36 playoff holes to determine the winner. And Bobby Jones loses in 36 playoff holes. But if he hadn't called a penalty on himself, then he wouldn't have ever been in that position. He would have won the U.S. Open by one stroke. Here's how a recent movie, Stroke of Genius, kind of tells that story. Check this out.
Who's better than us? Oh, you better show me something today, kid. Anyone can win one Open.
Official, I've caused my ball to move.
Oh, I didn't see it move. Yeah, I'm happy. I didn't see it. Bobby, we've talked with Walter, all the officials, and several people in the gallery. Nobody saw your ball move. Seems a matter for you to decide. Are you sure you caused that ball to move?
I know I did.
You'll be congratulated, son.
Sir, that's like congratulating a man for not robbing a bank. I don't know how else to play the game.
Bobby Jones lost the U.S. Open by one stroke. In calling a penalty on himself, he demonstrated for all of us the highest ideal of sportsmanship and personal honor. I'm prouder of him than if he'd won. There are things finer than winning championships.
That line that Bobby Jones said, that, sir, that's like congratulating a man for not robbing a bank, that wasn't just the movie script. By all accounts, that's what he actually said in 1925. He would take no credit for calling a penalty on himself. For him, it wasn't a hard decision. It was clear what he should do. But in retrospect, it's really not that clear. I mean, he could have won the U.S. Open, and nobody would have blamed him if he'd said, well, I guess if you didn't see it move, maybe it didn't. Maybe I'm wrong. I won't take... But for Bobby, it was a question of integrity. And he knew, perhaps even in that moment, that it would be easier to live his life long with a penalty that cost him a tournament versus living with a guilty conscience that he got it unfairly. See, golf is a game that tests our integrity. It tests our integrity in big and small ways. You keep your own score. You count your own strokes. When you're off in the woods and your partners, your friends aren't with you, they are the only ones. They can't watch you to know if you nudge the ball over just a little bit. You depend not just on your own integrity, but you depend on others' integrity when you're playing a round of golf. You trust them to keep track of their own score. And occasionally, you ever play a game with people where your memory and their memory doesn't quite match up? I had that happen my most recent. Eric and I were playing together. We paired up on different teams, and we were playing best ball, and my memory and their memory of the stroke count didn't quite match up a little bit, and we debated for a little bit, and then we just said, no, let's just drop it. It doesn't matter, because I didn't want, you know, the question of memory to become a question of integrity. Like, I didn't trust them. And of course, I told myself, well, it's just a game. There was no, you know, no bet riding on it. No one's getting financially or emotionally wounded. Just let it drop. But in life, it's not like that, is it? I mean, life depends on integrity, too. We depend on people to mean what they say and say what they do, right? We depend on people's integrity. But when integrity fails in life, well, you know, there are real consequences. One of my favorite books on integrity is a book by a guy named Dr. Henry Cloud. The name of the book is Integrity. If you want to look it out, look it up sometime. He spends his first couple chapters just making the case for why integrity is important. And what he talks about is, he says, you know, he goes through all of the, you know, the public debacles, all the headlines, all the epic fails of the last two decades. I mean, Enron, and politics, business, religion, pastors who get involved in sex scandals, sports, Lance Armstrong. He goes through all of those. He says in every single case, at its root, it was a failure of integrity at the core of the issue. And he says, and those are just the big things. Even in our small day-to-day mistakes and failures, if you look at it long and hard enough, it's always an issue of integrity. What I love about it is he defines integrity a little bit broader than just being honest. He says, see, think about it in terms of engineering. If you're asked to, you know, if you're an engineer and you have to design something, like a plane, well, the questions you might start to ask is, well, how fast does this plane need to go? And how high? And what does it need to carry? And what is its purpose? And as you begin to know what demands are going to be put on the plane, then you design a plane that's going to match, that's going to have the right materials, it's going to have the right build so that it can meet the demands that are put upon it. And the same, you know, you can think about any engineering project, a bridge, a dam, a computer network, an electrical grid. It's always about meeting the demands that are put upon it. And if you design it right, if your design has integrity, then it holds. And so that's how he defines integrity. Integrity is the ability to meet the demands of reality. That's a pretty broad definition. It includes being honest and accountable for the mistakes you make. But integrity also shows up when you're working with a boss or a coworker whose behavior is impacting the performance of the team. And do you speak up? That's a test of integrity. You're out in a public place, And your kid is having a meltdown, and their behavior is awful. And how do you respond in that moment? Your integrity is being tested. Or say you're on a business trip, and you're in your hotel room, and no one else is around. What do you watch? What do you do? Your integrity is being tested. And 99.9% of the time, when our integrity is tested, we pass through with flying colors. I believe that. But what happens the one or two times when our integrity fails? How do we recover when it counts? If you look at the story of Joseph, his integrity is tested over and over and over again. It's not always explicit. It's kind of implied. I mean, he goes from being just a random slave that Potiphar buys to being the head of the household. Well, how did he get there? Well, by meeting the demands of reality again and again and again. He did a task, earned the trust of Potiphar, who gave him a little more responsibility, a little more trust. He met those demands. He gave him a little more. And that process of trust and meeting the demands, to the point where he's suddenly the head of the household. He's in charge of all of his resources, material, people, money. He has the complete trust of Potiphar, his master. And then the ultimate test comes. And what's the test? It's Potiphar's wife who finds him desirable and attractive and wants to sleep with him. Now, what's the choice Joseph has here? You could say, you know, the one choice is he could choose to delight himself with Potiphar's wife or face punishment. Delight and punishment, that's pretty easy to decide what we choose. We choose delight most times. The same with Bobby Jones. Do I count myself a stroke and lose, or do I just keep on playing and win? That's a pretty easy choice. But for Bobby Jones and for Joseph, it's really about integrity. See, no matter what Joseph chooses, he's going to end up in prison. Either the choice he makes, which is to refuse Potiphar's wife, he ends up in a literal prison. But don't you see, if he also said yes to her, he'd be in a prison as well, a prison of lies and deception. He was stuck. Either way, he was going to lose. His choice was, what was he willing to lose? Was he willing to lose his sacrifice? Or was he willing to lose his character? Or was he willing to lose his reputation? Now, character and reputation, I've always thought of these two as somewhat binary, a little bit different because of Tony Dungy and his book, Quiet Strength. I read this quote years ago and has always stuck with me, but Tony Dungy says this. He says, others could determine your reputation, but only you determine your integrity. I mean, of the two, your character and your reputation, there's only one that you can control, and that's your integrity. But man, isn't it so easy to try to control our reputation? To try to present the facts in a way that puts you in the best possible light, to tell a little white lie, to shade the truth just a little bit, to preserve your reputation. It's so easy to do. So look what Joseph does. Does he try to preserve his reputation? No. Because he could have. I mean, if he had slept with Potiphar's wife, what would have been done would have been kept in secret. He would have held on to his position. He would have held on to his power. Now, I'm sure eventually it would have come to light, because all those things come to light eventually. But at least in the short term, he would have still had the reputation and power and the trust of Potiphar, his master. But he knows in the long run, he can't control that reputation. The only thing he could control was his character. And so what did he do? He ran from Potiphar's wife. Ran from temptation. But what happened to his reputation? It was attacked, trashed, drugged through the gutter. He ends up in prison. And he spends years in prison. And I'm sure sometime in prison, he thought to himself, man, I'm sure glad I got my character. It's serving me well down here. You know, like what good is character when you're down in a prison cell? But character always shows up. Character always matters wherever you might be. And it's because he preserved his character and because he preserved God's blessing and favor that he was ready for that next opportunity whenever it came. He eventually went on, if you know the story, to become the second in command to Pharaoh himself, the one in charge of all the distribution of grain during a time of famine. Joseph's integrity allowed him to save the lives of thousands. But none of that would have happened if he had sacrificed it for short-term gain and security. He chose character. It cost him, but in the long run, he won. And the only question I struggle with when I read this passage is I think, gosh, it's so clear, but why is it so hard? I mean, why is it so hard when we sense the least little fault or attack that we instantly protect ourselves, protect our reputation? Why is it so important to us the way people see us that we would sacrifice our character and our integrity to protect it? I mean, it's instinctive, isn't it? It goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. When God came and found them in the garden, instantly they start blaming, right? Well, Adam says, well, it was Eve who gave me the fruit. Eve says, well, it was the serpent. I mean, they just instantly pass the buck to protect themselves. My kids, no one ever had to teach them how to pass the blame. It just happens. It's not my fault, Dad. It was my sister. You know, yesterday, I mean, this is a quick story. We were at a baseball game, and And Nathan was waving over the sideline to our family, right? And he wanted our attention. And my daughter was on her phone. And the rest of us are waving, but Margaret's not. And then he gets a ground ball hit to him while he's waving over at us. So he misses the ball. And then the coach gets on him. And anyways, I can see, you know, the head go down. So I go over to the dugout. I'm like, come on, man. You doing all right? Get your head up. And he's like, it's Margaret's fault. She wasn't paying attention to me. I said, well, you pay attention to the ball. Let us do our, I mean, it's just instinctive, isn't it? It's just real. It's a real life story. It's real time. It happens. And so the key to integrity, honestly, is not about being perfect. It's not about being blameless. It's really about not passing the blame onto others. Not being so concerned about protecting our reputation that we're willing to sacrifice the truth. You see, 1 John 1:8 says it this way, if we say to ourselves that we have no sin, we are lying to ourselves, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. The truth hurts, it does, but the truth does not kill. The truth actually strengthens and corrects and teaches us. It actually forms our character and integrity in important ways. So in this story, look at the people who have low integrity and what they do. I mean, look at what Potiphar's wife does. She blames Joseph. Look at what Potiphar himself does. Instead of taking responsibility for what is likely an unhappy and unfaithful marriage, he casts blame too on Joseph and throws him in prison. Joseph himself is the only person who doesn't cast blame. And this is kind of amazing. Like, you go way forward in his life, when he's finally brought face to face with his brothers, he doesn't even cast blame then. He says, you know, that you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. He breaks down and cries when he sees them begging for their brother's life. And he never says it explicitly, but you can almost see him saying, you know what? I brought this on myself. I was such a jerk. I didn't get it at all. Sorry. When we're able to say those words, God uses them to create, to correct, to reform who we are inside. When I was in college, I was part of a concert choir similar to our chancel choir in the sanctuary. We sang lots of stuff in Latin, really difficult music, and it wasn't exactly fun. It wasn't like the church choir is part of, but and it was a big time commitment, like 4 hours a week, right? And my junior year, I was kind of getting tired of it, wasn't sure if I wanted to stick with it, and I made the choice. I had this bad week, and I just decided, you know what? I'm just going to skip today's rehearsal. Didn't go. And I don't know what I did with that time. I think I just slept, you know, took a nap or something. Afterwards, I called the director, because I knew I needed to apologize, and so I apologized for missing, and then I don't know why, I just did it halfway. Instead of being totally honest, I just made up an excuse about why I missed. And she didn't know any better. And she said, well, okay, thanks for telling me. And we hung up. And as soon as we hung up, I knew it. And I decided to call her back. And I said, Dr. Grazia, I just lied to you. The truth is, I didn't have whatever that excuse I made up was. The truth is, I just didn't feel like going, and I skipped it today. And there was silence on the other end of the phone. And finally she said, well, David, thanks for telling me. I appreciate it. Don't let it happen again. I said, I won't. That was it. A year later, when I was applying to go to seminary, I asked Dr. DeGrazia to write me a recommendation letter. When I got in to Duke, I talked to the admissions director. And he said, you know, out of everything, you know, out of all the applications we got, it was your recommendation letter that stood out. I mean, I can't even imagine how many hundreds or thousands of letters this guy reads. And he told me that my letter stood out. And I said, which letter? He says, well, it was the one from your choir director. So he wouldn't tell me what was in it, but I went to Dr. DeGrazia and I said, tell me, what did you say that got me into seminary, that got me a scholarship? What did you say? And she said, I just said, David Williamson does not tell lies. Man, I wish that were true. I do. I wish it were true, because I'm just as susceptible as you are to shading the truth. We all have this investment in protecting our image. But it's a statement that I try to live up to. It's worth shooting for, to be a guy that does not tell lies. And the thing is I think, you know, Dr. DeGrazia, she knew that my integrity would be tested, and she knew that I'd probably fail sometime. But in that moment when I called her back, it settled the question. She no longer questioned my integrity. She knew even when I messed up, I'd admit it and I'd learn and I'd grow from it. Joseph's integrity would continue to be tested his whole life long, but it would never be questioned. Bobby Jones' integrity would continue to be tested, but you know what? No one ever questioned it again. Because Bobby Jones settled the question once and for all, that it wasn't about winning if winning came at the expense of a divided character. Or let me say it differently. That of the two, inner wholeness is so much more important than outward perfection. So may God give us the grace to choose again and again and again an inward wholeness that only He can give. Amen.